Gentlemen, I'm going to ask that we stand for the invocation, and it will be given by Dean Leroy Howell. Professor Farmer has some words of appreciation at this time.
A great deal of work has been done by certain persons whose names need to be mentioned at this time. Mrs. Lee Cobb, Mrs. Vella Massey, Mrs. Ann Norris, Mrs. Jan Thomas, secretaries to the faculty, Mrs. Smith and those ladies working with her for the preparation of our dinner tonight, and then to our two deans, Dean Leroy Howe, who's just given the invocation, and Dean James Ward, who gave our invocation last night. We want to thank these people, and I speak for Nat as well as myself, and for all the others who've had a hand in the planning of the conference. Without the help of these people, it certainly wouldn't have been possible. Shall we give them all a hand?
Zan Holmes will have some words for us presently. He said he would be fresh, spontaneous in himself, and that's what we're looking to in terms of responding to what is going on here, after which we will have some feedback from our resource people and recorders, and then we'll have a film afterwards, and I think that will probably wrap up our evening pretty well. Zan?
Thank you, Nat. This is the first time that I have ever been listed on the program to give 30 minutes of remarks. But that is what I'm scheduled to do. I was just thinking as I walked into the room tonight that back in 1956, I came to Perkins School of Theology to enroll as a student. Finished in 1959. And then I spent 10 more years trying to get another degree that I finally got in 1968. And during all of those years, I have seen a lot of exciting things happen at SMU and here on the campus at Perkins School of Theology. But I must truly say to you tonight that, in my opinion, this particular conference has been one of the most exciting and rewarding experiences that I have witnessed here at Southern Methodist University since I've been here. I think it's been rewarding in many ways. For example, I was just informed that even during the short time that we've been in session in this conference, that the conference has responded already to some of the ongoing crises that we face here in the city of Dallas. I understand that today you drafted a statement that was presented to the officials of the Dallas Independent School District, which reads as follows. I don't think some of you are aware of it. The Conference on One Humanity wishes to express its concern for the high school seniors whose cases for expulsion are being heard this morning. Solutions which deal with symptoms rather than causes only compound the problems we face in American society. We urge officials of the Dallas Independent School District to weigh carefully the underlying causes of racism which have contributed to the present disturbances, not to take punitive action against its victims. Understand that the statement was delivered to officials of the Dallas Independent School District, by members of this conference, and that out of this experience, one member of the conference even came up with the suggestion that perhaps there is a need for us, in the event that these seven students are expelled, to work with them that they might become equipped to pass, I believe, some alternative test that can be given that will provide the high school, the equivalent of high school education. But I think that this one act certainly demonstrates that those of us who are participating in this conference are seeking to be responsive to the problems that are ours here in the city of Dallas. And for that, I certainly want to express my appreciation. When I was here on last evening, I heard one of the persons in the audience state that in conferences like this one, we usually see the same old faces over and over again, and that we've had the experience of going through these kind of conferences and coming out, you know, with nothing really happening as a result of all of our efforts. And that could happen here. This could be just another one of those merry-go-rounds upon which we ride. We get on at one place and we ride around and around and we get off exactly where we got on. The fact that that has happened in the past leads me to say that perhaps it is in order for us to engage in some confessions, to confess that perhaps one of the reasons why these conferences, such as the conferences such as this one, have ended up in nothing being accomplished, is not always because of something that somebody else has done, somebody on the outside has done to prevent something positive from coming out of these kind of conferences. But perhaps if we've been in all these conferences where we've been on all of these merry-go-rounds and getting on in one place and getting off exactly where we got on, maybe we share some of the guilt. Maybe we too are somewhat responsible for the fact that all too often nothing happens as a result of these kind of conferences. Maybe if this conference is going to be a different conference, we need first of all to confess that perhaps we ourselves, those of us who have been participating in these conferences, have not been as faithful and arriving at the goals that we have set for ourselves. Maybe we need to confess that even as we continue in this particular conference here tonight, that we come with certain limitations. We are limited by numbers, yes, but we are limited because we too are not all entirely free to make the kind of risk that somebody said that we're going to have to make if we're really going to ever realize one humanity in our world. We're limited we are not all free to do all that we know we ought to do, or that all that we want to do, and maybe we need to confess that. That we do have those hang-ups, and that to a certain extent our hands, so we say, are tied. That we participate in those structures that we condemned, and that we to a certain extent are controlled by those structures that we seek to change. All of us, to some extent. And so that's perhaps is a given that we ought to confess. And having confessed that, perhaps to try to do what we can, given the limitations that are ours as we seek to bring about meaningful change in our society and as we seek to work toward this goal of one humanity. I think perhaps if something is to come out of this conference, a word ought to be said about communication. All too often, we talk about the two societies of which the Kerner Report speaks that are developing in our nation today. Yet I would suppose that you can break down those two societies into a whole lot of other little societies wherein there is not any real communication. One of the participants in the conference came up to me after the session last night, and he was telling me about something that was going on in the Chicano community. And at the same time saying to me that this was something that was not known and that he wished he had had an opportunity to share this with me at an earlier time and how important he thought it was. And we talked about this whole matter of here we are, those of us who come together in conferences like this and who embrace the goal of one humanity. Quite often we find ourselves out doing our own little things over in our various little corners, and we're not communicating among ourselves, let alone with that other so-called society that we're trying to engage, of which we are seeking to bring together that we might have one humanity. It reminds me of the story of this man who went out one day to buy himself a new pair of pants, and he came home, and after he got home, he tried the pants on, and he discovered that the pants were 2 inches too long. And so he asked his wife, who was there in the house, if she would do him a favor and cut 2 inches off the pants so that he could wear them the next morning. And she was one of these working wives, one of these liberated wives, and said that she didn't have time to do it, that she was tired, and, you know, and so she finally went to bed for the night, and so this poor brother decided that if he were going to get his pants fixed, he would have to do it himself, and so he's, his mother-in-law was there, and so he asked his mother-in-law if she would do it, and she was one of these mother-in-laws, you know, who had the responsibility of keeping the children all day, and she said that she was tired too, and she didn't feel like doing it, and so she went to bed the night. And so then this poor brother decided that the only way he was going to get his pants altered so that he could wear them the next morning, he would have to do it himself. And so he sat down, got the scissors, cut off 2 inches of the pants, took them, placed them over the chair, and he went to bed for the night. Well, about 12 o'clock, his wife woke up, and she said, "You know, I didn't treat my husband right." And she said, "I'm going to get those pants and fix them for him, like he asked me to do." So she tipped in and she got the pants and she cut off 2 inches and she placed them back across the chair, and you know what happened next, don't you? The mother-in-law woke up and she said to herself, "I didn't treat my son-in-law right," and so she went and got the pants and cut off 2 more inches, and to make a long story short, you can imagine how that man felt the next morning when he woke up and put on his Bermuda shorts. But you know, I think this is really what we do to each other. this is really what we do oftentimes to those, you know, that we seek to help when we don't have a communication network, when we are not well coordinated in our efforts. That which we do in our little corners in the name of good can actually destroy those whom we seek to help when we really don't communicate, when we really do not coordinate our efforts. And I would hope, and here again, I'm introducing my agenda here. I would hope that somehow we can deal with this matter of communications in this conference. And I feel that if something is to come out of it, if there is going to be a continuing effort, that there must be a communications network. I didn't intend to talk this long. One final thing. I have heard a lot of talk about the myth of the melting pot in America, and I'm not so sure that is a myth, really, because there is borrowing among cultures in our society today. It seems to me the problem is not so much the melting pot, whether or not there's a melting pot, so much as it is who's determining the ingredients that go into the melting pot. You know, what's being left out of that melting pot? Who's stirring the ingredients? Then, after the ingredients have been stirred, who's invited to sit down at the table to partake of what's been cooked up in that melting pot? And some of us, and I'm speaking from the standpoint of black experience here at this point, some of us blacks have been good ingredients. We've been used as ingredients in that melting pot, in some melting pots, and we've been stirred in that melting pot. But when the dish is all cooked up, we haven't been invited to sit down at the table to share the good that's come out of the pot. Case in point, you know, we had a black bank, so-called black bank, that was established over in South Dallas several years ago. Folk were saying black folk need to have a bank. And so several black folk were asked to be on the board of directors of this bank that was going to serve the black community. And the bank became a reality. Of course, later on, I discovered that in getting a bank charter, that at that particular time in history, you know, that it was very helpful to have some black folk on the bank board. You know, the melting pot was being created, you see. The black ingredient had to be there. And the bank was started and stayed in the black community for about, I don't know if it stayed there a year. And y'all know where that bank is today, don't you?
downtown, and it ain't serving the black community. It's down there serving somebody else, you see. So we did not partake of the ingredients of that particular batch, you know, that went into that melting pot. So we have some melting pots. And we have this pluralistic culture, you know, and where, you know, everybody's saying today we've got to have, you know, the all of the cultures, blending of the cultures on our colleges and in our schools, in the churches and everywhere. But to whose benefit? Which leads me to say here, in conclusion, that, you know, we can have us a little melting pot here in this conference. And we can determine some ingredients that are going to go into this pot. And then we too can help determine who's going to be served as a result of what we mix up here in this conference. I do truly believe that this particular conference has a real possibility of not being another merry-go-round, but of resulting and some fruits that can really get at some of our basic concerns and enable us to move closer to our goal in some fashion, some form or the other, our goal of one humanity. Believe it or not, I've rambled and I've given some off-the-cuff remarks for 30 minutes. I'd like to now introduce Neil Douglas, who is going to present our reporters from our groups.
It's been my privilege to have participated, along with several other national resource people, in the conference in the last day and a half, and we're looking forward to tomorrow as well. It's my pleasure to introduce each of them to you, following which I will call upon five of the national resource people who have served as recorders for each of the five groups, to share with you the findings that have emerged thus far in the various discussions. First of all, Dr. Sterling Carey, and perhaps each person could rise after I've introduced them. Dr. Sterling Carey, President of the National Council of Churches, Executive of the Metropolitan Association of New York United Church of Christ. Marilyn Clement, Assistant Director, Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, New York, for 5 years. Former Dallas resident, organizer, has worked for 2 years with SCLC and in grassroots organizing in Atlanta. Ms. Debbie Wilkins, student at Pembroke State, North Carolina, member of the Native American Caucus of the United Methodist Church, Board of National Mission, attended recently the World Council of Churches Conference on Power and Development in Puerto Rico. Mr. Cameron King, from St. Vincent's Island, near Barbados, information officer for the government of St. Vincent, specializes in communication and interested in inter-island communication. Cameron also attended the Puerto Rican meeting on power and development sponsored by the World Council of Churches, and has spent the last 3.5 weeks on an extensive tour throughout the country visiting with various groups. Dr. Donald Shriver, professor of ethics and society and director, doctor of ministry program, Candler School of Theology, Emory University in Atlanta. Reverend Robert Parsonage is a newly elected staff member of the National Council of Churches, serving as associate executive director of the Department of Higher Education. He comes to the council after serving for the past 10 years as chaplain and professor of religion at Springfield College in Massachusetts. Mr. Poikiel George, member of the East Indian Church, staff associate for the Action Education Task Force for Justice, Liberation, and Development of the National Council of Churches. Poikiel attended school here at SMU Perkins longer ago than he would, I think, care to admit. And I am Neil Douglas, an assistant to the General Secretary. I carry a portfolio of planning and research. And now, if I may, I would like to call upon the five people that have served as recorders for your process, and with your indulgence, they will share their reflections and observations concerning this process, feeding back the highlights and recommendations of the group discussion. Bob Parsonage first.
I'm reporting for the group mark number 2 on your program. After a good deal of preliminary conversation about the purposes of the conference, and about the problems confronted by this particular group of citizens of Dallas, the group attempted to establish its own agenda of issues, to assign some priorities to those issues for the purposes of our discussion and work together, and agreed to deal with the issues at two levels, from two perspectives, to ask the question first, what ought to be done about each of these issues which we see to be so important? And secondly, to ask what can we as participants in this conference, what are we as participants in this conference capable of doing about these problems? The issues selected for consideration by the group and somewhat according to their priority were the following. First, the issue of public education, the problem of desegregation, the positive possibility of integration, the concern for quality education for all. Secondly, the problems of senior citizens in Dallas, the need for services and the right for dignity and for a role of participation in the life of this community. Third, a variety of issues dealing with what we chose to call the problem of the progress of Dallas at the expense of its poor people. Fourth, the problem of obtaining accurate assessments of the concerns and needs of the citizens of Dallas, particularly of the poor and the dispossessed. Fifth, the problem of housing, and last, the issue of drug abuse and addiction. In our consideration of what ought to be done, and also our consideration of what this group felt it was capable of doing, the group acknowledged that its desire to eliminate social injustice and to obtain reform in each of these areas has in the past and continues to be difficult because there's been a lack of strategy for effecting social change, because of a feeling of frustration in attempting to gain the attention and interest of what seemed to be an apathetic majority in the community, and because of the problems of influencing the existing channels of communication. The group also realized that people are moved to act for different reasons, principally out of self-interest, because they're compelled to do so because of the law, and somewhat sadly, we thought, in third order, because of conscience, because of desire to achieve change. The group therefore agreed that any strategy for action it was going to devise to be realistic and effective would have to address itself to the problems that these people had encountered in trying to bring about change previously, and would have to account for the basic motives which impel people to act. For all of these reasons, the group, quite remarkably in my mind, came to some rather firm and carefully articulated recommendations. First, the second group recommends that this conference establish itself on a continuing basis in the form of a steering committee, which should continue its work on the problems which have been identified by the participants of this conference as the most pressing issues that citizens of Dallas must face. Further, this group recommends that the conference establish, through its steering committee, a series of task forces to continue to deal with the several particular issues that have been arising all day. The group recommends that the task forces be composed of a wide range of Dallas citizens representing various ethnic, racial, religious, professional, and public interest groups which have a stake in the issues to be dealt with or some special competency to contribute to the particular task forces. For example, and most of our examples deal with our priority in group two, that of public education. For example, this group believes that a task force on public education should include in its membership citizens representative of various ethnic communities and groups, a lawyer or two, a public relations expert, personnel of or consultants to the public school system, and university faculty competent in educational research. This group recommends that the task forces and steering committee be accountable to those groups and persons who have called this conference into being: the National Council of Churches, SMU and Perkins, and representatives and organizations of the local community. This group believes that not only is there responsibility of this conference to do its work, but now a continuing responsibility of those very groups who called this conference into being. And so our group very much wanted to establish a firm idea and system of accountability from the beginning. So everyone is forewarned. Group two recommends that the task forces determine their own strategy for dealing with their particular issues. However, we wanted to offer the following suggestions for the task force on public education, having spent so much of our time and energy dealing with that particular priority. We recommend that the task force on public education focus its attention on working with the widest possible variety of community groups to raise up the issues of quality education for all the children of Dallas and to ensure that integration be a positive experience for this community. These groups with whom this task force should work, we believe, would include, among others, parents, the business community, the mass media, the church and university committees, and public officials. Our group wishes to offer a number of specific suggestions for the work of a task force on public education, which will suggest something of the scope and the depth of our concern that the task force work with a variety of groups and appeal to citizens of this community on the basis of all the reasons that might cause them to act positively in this particular area of concern. Our suggestions are to the, at this point, mythical task force on public education, and our suggestions for the kind of demands and concerns they should share with others in this community. We suggest that the task force on public education take as one of its first priorities to getting together with the business leadership, the business community of Dallas, to begin to sensitize them to the issues of the school crisis and to see more clearly their self-interest and their role of leadership. We suggest to the task force on public education that it begin to work with the institutions of higher education in this community and to get them to collaborate to do such things as massive remedial work for the blacks and other minorities in this community, help in placing minority students in colleges, collaboration to conduct laboratories for teachers of the public schools to help sensitize them to the problems and educate them to new insights on their role in integration, and that the institutions of higher education in this community conduct more research on education from the perspective from the viewpoint of being concerned for the quality of education and of integration as a positive possibility. A real concern expressed in our group that institutions of higher education in selecting what kind of research they're going to do can have a great deal to do if they will take this one on to make the whole issue of integration a much more positive and exciting one for this community. There are recommendations we would offer to the task force as it works with the churches. It's our suggestion that the task force call on the churches and synagogues of this community to encourage parents to send their children to public schools and to continue their support of public schools, to encourage congregations to be real forums where issues of education and the hurts and concerns that people feel about education will be listened to and taken seriously, that the churches devise new and more forceful means of communicating the views of faith and of the members, the laymen of those churches, on education to the political and business leadership of this community, and that the task force challenge the churches and synagogues through the Council of Churches, through the various interfaith organizations in this community, to take on the religious community in terms of the issue of public education as their first priority, to take them on in the hopes of getting the institutions of religion in this community committed to quality education for all the citizens of Dallas. We suggest further that in the appeals to self-interest and to law and to conscience, there are other ways that a task force on public education could be effective. Let me suggest just from one of those areas, the appeal to law. It was the concern of the members of Group 2 that the task force on public education have some immediate relationship and an ongoing relationship with the lawyers who are representing the desegregation case in this community, that there be an ongoing relationship with the tri-ethnic committee to help them seek compliance with the court-ordered plan for integration, to form a cooperating role with them as a means of feeding suggestions to that committee for its work, and to begin to work on alternative plans for integration in case the one before the court is turned down. Further suggested in this area that this task force take on a supportive role on the legal and legislative issues dealing with school problems in this community. These are just some of the suggestions that we raise up for one of a number of task forces that would, as this group hopes, be a continuing means of the concern of this conference being carried out and not being laid to rest tomorrow morning. I was very excited and pleased to work with this particular group and have a special word to say for the leadership of our group and also for the senior citizens in this group who were quite willing to lay aside their concerns about their own issues to deal with the issue of public education, which they said was their issue also. Thank you.
Cameron King.
First of all, let me say a word about the group in which I was. From the point of view that, to me, this particular group was, in a sense, a model of what happens or what ought to happen in the community. That with honesty of purpose and the willingness to put the cards on the table, we meet one another and express there the common basis on which we can work. And I think this is precisely what the group tried to do in arriving at some kind of basic discussion and some kind of concrete suggestions. I think there was expressed the disappointment that in this kind of honesty, a certain section of the community was obviously conspicuous by its absence. But the expectations were basically, even before conclusions were arrived at, that there had to be this basic honesty, that there had to be commitment on the part of people, that out of this commitment could come continuity and some kind of realistic program. That being done, I think the group itself, as I said at the beginning, in its approach, its methodology, really enacted what can happen and what ought to happen in a community. First of all, I think it mapped out what were the issues of relevance. And excuse me if, instead of going into rare detail on the question of some of the discussion, I indicate the basis on which the group operated. Looking at the issues of relevance in the community, what are the problems? Those are the questions asked. What are the problems that concern this community, the vital problems, the most strategic areas? What are they? Are they employment, transportation, housing, welfare, the elderly, that is, education? All of these are vital issues. And I think what came out of the discussion was, in fact, that many people were knowledgeable on particular areas. But I think it would be fair to the group to say that they came to the conclusion that obviously, although each person had a great deal to offer in terms of suggestions and in terms of analysis in housing, in the question of jobs, of discrimination, of education as a key factor, that the most important factor or idea at the back of the minds of each person was, I think, raised very cogently by one member. And that is, when you have problems, you become emotionally involved. And the emotional involvement in problems makes it sometimes difficult to get to the basic facts. But most important are the basic facts. What are the real facts? It is only on this basis can we arrive at successful solutions. Otherwise, the experience that was recounted will continue to recur. That is the feeling that you can help, and when you pitch in and help, maybe a year later you look back on it and you say, maybe we shouldn't have done that. Maybe. So the approach here was to look at the possibility within your total community. Look at people who are, shall we say, experts. So let us say people who have built up an area of expertise in particular directions. And by pooling these resources, people who have been specializing in going into the problem of employment, ecology, of these different aspects of the community's total problems, to get out of that a sort of pool of expertise with which to work. And that expertise could meet in some kind of coalition through the groups working in these various areas, and then sit down to define the basic elements of the problem. In other words, I think what this group was trying to do was to look at the thing in a way that most of us are not able or have not. Most of us get so concerned with our own particular interests or self-interests or particular hang-ups, whether they be the black community or the Indians or the Chicanos or the white community, that we cannot see the total dimension. We cannot see things in their overall perspective. And I think the whole idea was that before calling on the university as an aid in research function to provide inputs, the community represented in this way through a coalition of groups had to find out for itself what it really wanted. What do you want? That is the important point. Nobody can tell you, no professors locked into a particular academic system perhaps, and as a result, seeing theoretical models, but maybe not as totally involved in the actual struggle themselves, can decide for you what is the problem. But when you have defined and said what you want, the expertise exists to go to them and to say in an atmosphere of sharing, in a feeling of sharing, this is the kind of help we want. You have students who can be involved in proposals. You have students who are studying law who can be involved in the ghettos. Students who can be involved in the actual situations, the actual stuff of living, and who can, through this kind of experience, really make a contribution. I think the group moved from this question of issues and its discussion to what kind of strategy, what kind of enabling strategy, what kind of strategy can we have that will permit not only an exploration on a realistic and accurate level of the complexities behind these problems, of the differing points of view that emerge, the fact that all blacks don't think alike, that all whites don't think alike, that people cannot be lumped into blocks, that you have to have research, that it is impossible to make really effective concrete suggestions until you have discovered. And the only way you can discover this brings us to the main point of the enabling strategy, through some sort of communication system. I would say that the basic issue in terms of enabling for this group was the question of communications. How can you set up a situation in which the people in different groups know what each person, what each group is doing? They don't have to be together. I think this came out very strongly. They do not have to work together in the closest possible manner. They simply have to be in communication and constant contact so that at all points it is possible to see a total picture of what is going on and how each group, how each set of persons can contribute to this, so that all the resources can be used. So that one aspect or dimension of communications was the question of intergroup contact, setting up a consistent structured or group which would permit a constant feed-in, cross-feeding, feeding back into situations, on situations. The other aspect that was raised and obviously is going on, and I think in this we have to understand that there are groups already doing this kind of thing, but not, possibly not approaching it on this kind of perspective that we're talking about, from a national point of view or from a concerted point of view that enables you to develop all the human resources you have and use them towards the solution of the problems. The other strategy was obviously to get to the people whom you're trying to help and get their support, their moral support. And I think that what came across here very clearly was that the communications media in the territory are not really performing the true function. And it seemed to me that there were some groups working on a possibility of making the media toe the line, deal with the issues of importance, reflect the culture of the community in its deepest sense and in its overall sense, not simply the culture of a particular group. And I would say that my own reflections on this was simply that it had a limited application because of the nature of the communication structure. I think at this point I'd like to bring up what came as a very important input into this group's findings, into its discussion, into its own sort of analysis. And this is that some people wanted to see things in a purely national sense. National in the sense that these are the problems of Dallas. And as such, let us focus on these. And for the moment, keep that focus narrowed. And I think other people brought in another important dimension, that we should see the Dallas situation within the context of a global situation, within the context of the world, so that it could be understood that getting a piece of the pie in one sense in Dallas for more people meant a tighter squeeze by the power structure, by the powers that are on people in the rest of the world. I think there were two dimensions here. One of them was that it isn't simply a question, because you are in a difficult situation, in a situation of deprivation, it isn't a question of getting a piece of the pie. Because too often, simply getting a piece of the pie without thinking of the basis on which you got it meant absorption, conversion to the values, the very values, and the system that you're trying to modify, to change, to make more humane, to produce more social justice. I think the complexity of this is what came out, that perhaps you have to have phases of the strategy. Perhaps you have to understand that some people, because of their situations, because of their positions, cannot jump from one position to the next. That it might be necessary to have a piece of the pie while understanding that if you continue to have it on this basis, you are in fact making the matter worse. So that is one dimension, I think, that came out. The other dimension was that globally, and I think I had this contribution to offer perhaps, globally, and talking about the third world and the impact of what happens in the United States on the third world, it is true that if you consider yourselves part of the third world because of your suffering, because you shared the same problems of injustice, of inhumanity, of dehumanization, of the failure to consider yourselves, or our failure to consider ourselves within the Dallas community as simply human beings and nothing more, seeing ourselves in that light. If you share this, then you are part of the third world, if you share this kind of perspective. But at the same time, if there are people who can see themselves as being part of the privileged world of the United States, part of the people who are lucky, who are good Americans, who have been doing such great and beautiful things for people in the third world, in Africa and Asia and Latin America, then you need to correct that perspective. You need to correct that vision. And the corrected vision is simply saying that you, the rich, the contented, the well-off, have grown rich and contented of us in the third world. We are the ones who have made it possible for you to enjoy that affluence and that wealth, because you have stated that it is necessary to your existence, because you have made sure that you've grappled unto yourself or taken unto yourself the elements of power that make this possible, the elements of destructive power, the elements that contain within their use the seeds of their own destruction and yours. And the question that emerges to conclude on this particular, to conclude this particular point, is simply that we in the third world, in Africa, in Asia, and Latin America, will no longer permit ourselves to be used as your enrichers. The third world is saying this, and saying it in a sense of community on a global dimension. And I think that what this meant, or what was significant about it, for this group and for the conclusions and for the feedback to you, is simply that when the third world says we will no longer tolerate this, when even in little nations like Guyana there is nationalization, when in Jamaica the Jamaicans take over their banks, when in tourism we say that we will not be exploited any further, that we will not see the resources of our countries used for other people's benefits and for injustice, then the backlash returns like a boomerang to the United States, to the people in the United States, because the system of production of wealth is built on this kind of expansion. The United States has to expand to continue in the particular system in which it is working. And if it cannot expand, then the people will have to be bled. And I think that the real point that came out of this is that we tend to polarize things too much. We tend to say that we are the oppressed, you, the white ones, are the oppressors. It isn't so simple. I think it is much more obvious that there are a few, a very few, but very powerful oppressors. And those who seem to be our immediate oppressors are the oppressed, made to seem the oppressors by the skillful manipulation of the system, which permits them to be rewarded in some small measure. So I think that that global input was very important, because what it was saying to Americans wherever they are, particularly to people in Dallas, is that the question of social justice, of humanity, of living in a certain way as human beings, as accepting each other as human beings, and living in harmony that permits a mutual giving and sharing so that people can be dealt with like human beings. This question is not simply a matter of, we think we should help you, we should give charity to you. It is a question of survival, whether you like to believe it or not. It is a question of survival, of whether you will continue a system of injustice. And the point is that this is the kind of dimension that the people who are the oppressors must have, if they are, in fact, to relent, because every man operates on the basis of his self-interest. And if you are going to be destroyed as a result of what you think is a rational policy or good policy, then you're going to change that policy. So, to conclude, I think the group came out, therefore, with the very clear suggestion that what was needed is a coalition of groups who know what they're doing, what their goals are, what their aims are, and who, as a result of this, can sit down together and exchange and share so that you get a total dimension, that you see things in this perspective. Communications, systems, or structures that permit continuing contact, a system that permits reaching the masses for support in the educational sense of the word, and allowing people to have a vision of their society in its complexity, and a focus. I think that was suggested, but the group before dealt with that, so I won't go into that. A focus on education in its specialized sense. The fact that communications means education, both in its specialized and in its general sense. Specialized because in the school, the key place for changing people's viewpoints, for producing citizens who will change society, that's where it is, in the school. And in the school, communications, systems, and techniques are vital. And on the outside, education in its most general sense, which, to me, and I think that this is probably the most important point of the whole group conclusion for me as an outsider, that communication within this society, within this community, must mean sharing. It has to be two-way. It means that you become a part of the whole experience of sharing, so that one always has a picture of where you are, what your feelings are, and where can we go from there. And finally, the group really expressed its desire, as the last group, as the report in the last group did, to have some kind of continuity come out of this. And it felt that by implementing this kind of strategy, this kind of structure, that one could, in fact, have this communication.
Miss Debbie Wilkins.
I'm from Group 5. I think the major proposal generating from Group 5's discussion was the idea of task forces, implementing the priorities established by the conference on this basis, involving volunteers and conference participants. So the idea of continuity. You can't hear me? No? 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 now, okay? Emphasizing over and over again, as you've heard, the idea of continuity, and for this conference to not really continue, but really begin after Tuesday. The role of the task forces, as we envisioned it, would also include support for already existing community groups who are involved in affecting social change in the established systems, and mobilizing groups and concerned citizens. Four major areas that were dealt with in our group, and I'll list them, were one, senior citizens; two, Wesley Rankin Center's relationship to the Mexican-American community; three, community action to meet immediate personal, social, and economic needs while making long-range plans for social change. And the fourth was the question, what is the role of the institution in the community? And I'll now give you the details of the issues. And the first, senior citizens. A specific problem was discussed at length of senior citizens program in Dallas, and that was that $20,000 was designated to the senior citizens by the city council on the basis of a survey initiated and conducted by the senior citizens in examining social conditions. Money was used to set up then another bureaucratic organization that established offices for staff persons responsible for, quote, counseling the aged. So the issue you see here is that someone else defines for the group its needs and determines its methods without consulting the senior citizens themselves. And that gets back to the whole idea of treating the symptoms rather than getting at root causes. The idea coming out, other ideas were a task force that would support the initiatives of the senior citizens themselves, that a task force attend meetings at the Crossroads Center and ask what avenues they can take to maybe dump staff persons in order to free funds for the group. Another idea was to, coming out of this meeting at Crossroads Center, but perhaps there could be a slot on television, perhaps a news conference, in that the task force would raise and examine the idea of while Social Security benefits have increased, there's been a decrease in old age assistance therein. Costs go up, but the amounts are the same. Amounts received are the same. Another idea was a task force would contact key corporations. Veterans groups was an example, soliciting and pursuing areas for available funds for senior citizens. A task force could compile a listing of existing organizations, community action programs that may have resources for senior citizens. The second area we dealt with was the Wesley Rankin Center. It is involved in the Mexican-American community under the auspices of the Methodist and Lutheran churches. Needs were expressed, and some of those were that indigenous leadership is necessary so that they can define for themselves the problems there and the ways and means of dealing with those problems, utilizing the resources of and having the support of church bodies and local powers. So it's a process of enablement, you hear again, rather than doing for or helping deprived, oppressed groups. Other needs are paid staff, tutoring and counseling. All this involves self-development funds. At this point, Wesley Rankin is run by an Anglo-racist deaconess who does not understand the people and thus has a fear of them and their, quote, demands. Systems that need to be challenged. Personnel policies of the Methodist Church. A task force to challenge the ex officio members to pressure board members of Wesley Rankin Center. The task force could align itself with the Committee on Mexican-American Ministries, Director Ruben Salcido, to examine social problems in the Mexican-American community and to help implement goals defined by the Mexican-Americans. The third area that we discussed was the issue of church and community action in meeting immediate needs. It must be aware, or they must be aware, these community action programs and projects coming out of the churches, of the danger of objectifying a race, objectifying a cause in messianic terms and style. Are the liberal, progressive notions of doing something for persons in need through remedial band-aid projects enough? So we must examine the whole idea of internal mission, local mission to deprived and oppressed peoples. The idea is that there has to be a redistribution of power and resources. We didn't deal with that in depth at all. We just raised that. And the task forces could deal with that more in depth later. And then the final issue, the final area that we discussed rather briefly was the role of the institution itself. The idea was a task force bringing together the Greater Dallas Conference, SMU, the annual conference, and the business local business people in dialogue to discuss in depth the very idea of the role of the institution in the community.
Don Shriver.
I'm sure members of our task group have the feeling that I have, that if you wait long enough in any meeting, you will find that somebody else will say what you wanted to say. Thereby, I think I can be relatively short, because a large part of what we did have to say is a matter now of saying amen to what has already been reported. I would like to say this, though. This was almost a unique conference for me, because in this group particularly, we actually practiced what we concluded. Namely, that people in big, powerful institutions like universities and governments should do more listening to their constituencies. Now, somebody did a very neat job of organizing this conference, making it impossible for some of us to avoid listening to some very persuasive people. I'll steal a little of Neil Douglas's thunder and say that one thing we experience in our group is the power of the rising tide of the lobby of elderly people in this country. And Neil and I, as members of the middle class elite of this country, have concluded that among the people we want on our side is elderly people. Well, that's not just Whistling Dixie. By the way, Among the four of these recorders, I think I'm the only native Southerner so far. And that shows you something about what real pluralism is. I'm glad at least one of us white Anglo-Saxon Protestants sort of made it into this group. But anyway, we listened. I mean, we actually listened to some people who call themselves senior citizens. That was a sobering and a beneficial experience. Among other things, we too came up with the idea that Debbie has just brought forward, that this proposal of the South Dallas Senior Citizens Committee, a proposal for the establishment of a unit in the Crossroads Community Center to work exclusively with problems of senior citizens. Now, you know, one of the neat things that was done about preparing for this conference was the preparation of this proposal, I suppose, over the last year, 18 months. That's one of the nicest proposals for community self-help that I have ever seen. And I want to tell you something about that proposal. That proposal has to do with senior citizens wanting to help themselves. They want to help each other. They'd like to earn a little extra money for doing work that is worth money. I mean, there is nothing in this proposal that Richard Nixon could disapprove of. Which is to say that I, for one, regard it as highly fundable. And I'm just amazed that it isn't funded yet. And I guess one of the conclusions that our group came to is that all this proposal needs is a boost from a few of the right people who are smart enough to do a little politicking to get what turns out to be in today's world a small amount of money. I mean, all they want is from $25,000 to $50,000, and all of us in the eastern part of this country know that that's a little bit of money in Dallas, Texas. And since the university is supposed to have a lot of the right and a lot of smart people in it, we figured there must be people around here who can give the necessary boost to get this amount of money. So that's sort of our recommendation. And we've got some details in what I hope will be maybe the published part of our report. We've got some ideas about who ought to do it. And I will not mention their names. Most of them I do not know personally. But some people in our task, in our discussion group, know you personally, and they think that you ought to be the ones to go get this money. And way out in Atlanta, you know, one of these days, I hope I get a postcard from Bill Farmer saying so-and-so got it. Anyway, I will withhold some of my prayers for you until you do get it. All right, that's getting more personal. I'm an academic and a preacher. And I don't enjoy reporting for other people. So you can blame Neil Douglas. I'm not a very good choice in that way. But what I would like to do, instead of handing you all the details, many of which I think are terribly important, and I hope you can read them out of our group, I would like simply to summarize for you the one point that we spent a lot of time on, and which I think I do have some business really emphasizing in the report from my own background, and because our group also emphasized it. And that is, what is the significance of this frequently echoed business from these reports about listening to people? What's the significance of that for professional education? We know that this conference was sponsored by some far-sighted people at Perkins School of Theology and at Southern Methodist University, and we congratulate them for that. We think the conference has a lot to say to the sponsors concerning their own philosophy of education. I mean, some of us are ready to believe that the professional communities of the world, really, of the Western world, are facing a crisis of confidence, partly because they have somehow acquired the illusion it is all right not to listen to one's patients or clients or constituents or whatever you want to call the people the professions are supposed to serve. Take any one of their professions in today's America, the law, medicine, the ministry, social work, or what have you, and there is a brewing among the great mass of citizens, one or another kind of hostility against their professions for daring to tell people what they want. Now, I will not speak for the doctors or the lawyers or the social workers, but for the ministers. I grant to ministers that there is less reason, to some extent, to think that all of us know exactly what we want. It may be that God knows better what we need rather than we ourselves, but at least none of us is God, so it little behooves us to tell somebody else what he wants. It does behoove us to listen. Indeed, it would seem that the ministry particularly needs to develop an ability to listen, and I think that it is to the credit of the discipline of pastoral care and pastoral counseling over the past 10 or 15 years, that skill to listen to individuals has sort of been brought into the theological curriculum. That's fine, but it's not fine enough. We must teach the leaders of the church also to listen to the community at large, to go out and to find data that is needed and know how to read it about institutional and community problems. And this means beginning to do so not later than one's course in the professional school. And this means also a word about faculty. It seems to me that the challenge to theological students and theological faculty is almost the same here. And if I read my group's response right, they agree that there's a lot of research that needs to be done on social problems these days, but the university and the professional academic alone should not be allowed to define all the problems for research. There's a kind of poverty abroad, especially in our complicated urban civilization, which might be called information poverty. It came out in our group. Lots of agencies and people standing around, it might do something about problems, and some of us had never heard of them before. That's information poverty. A lot of emphasis here about communication systems. Well, we need communication, all right, but two-way communication, indeed, on occasion, that supposedly poor and supposedly not very well educated community of people outside the perimeters of the university needs to come to the university, knock on its door, and say, look here, Mr. PhD, we need some information, some research on this subject, and we want you to do it for us. And he may turn around and say, well, I'm sorry, in my academic field, that's not a question we're much concerned about these days. And it may just be that with this rising tide of hostility, that there's just going to be an awful lot of people who are going to say, well, that's just too bad about you and your academic field, and I'm afraid they'll use stronger language than that. Anybody who's been in the research business very long knows that there's almost an infinite number of research projects. How do we choose between them? Well, I'll let the secret out in case you didn't know. There are two ways we choose. One is whether the idea enters our individual mind or not. And another way is when somebody comes with money to buy research on that subject. Now, all our group is saying, the community has a right on occasion to make a petition that academic minds accept ideas from the community and not only ideas from themselves. And perhaps there's also a strategy suggestion in all this, that sometimes agencies that want to have justice for the poor should put money into the hands of the poor so they can go buy their own research to serve their own interest. If rich farmers can do that through our land-grant universities, maybe people of all sorts and conditions in our cities can do that, especially in universities like this one, which are supposedly standing in some sense in the name of the Christian church. Because at least we, whatever the secular universities may have to say, at least we believe that the university is not put here simply to sell services to people rich enough to pay academic fees. The university is not here simply to give out knowledge to people who can pay or to follow the interest of people that happen to be on its faculty. The university is not even here simply to serve the cause of truth, because I read in the Bible that we are to love God and our neighbor. I do not read that we are simply to love the truth. And I know that's heresy, especially within the 300-year-old recent tradition of the scientifically oriented academic university. But I got some good philosophical and theological reasons for believing that, and I'll do battle on that point personally with anybody that wants to enter into that battle. At any rate, we think universities should come clean and become instruments of social justice by becoming places where all sorts and conditions of people can get the information that is necessary to serve the enrichment of their humanity.
Marilyn Clement.
My sense is that everybody is very tired, and much of what my group talked about has been talked about here, so I'm going to be very brief and just touch on the two or three suggestions that came out of our group that haven't already come out. One thing that kept coming out in our group was that Dallas is a very religious community. That religion, whether it's Christianity or not, religion is at the heart of Dallas. And that's a place where a lot of people are touched. And so one of the very first concerns that came out, and it really surprised me, was the question of the prayer breakfast that's going to be held sometime this next month. And it was raised in the group, you know, if the Dallas community is going to be having a prayer breakfast that's supposed to encompass the whole community, then we ought to be praying about something that's concerning the whole community. And so the question of education was raised, the educational crisis, and should we not raise those issues at the Dallas prayer breakfast? So three suggestions were made. And we didn't really get to the point yet of how those are to be implemented, but one was that the issue of education be raised at that huge prayer breakfast, and that folks who are concerned about that be brought into that prayer breakfast. Students, high school students in mass, and senior citizens who were also in our group and said that this was a great concern of theirs. Okay, another concern, just one other suggestion that came out about senior citizens. The senior citizens in our group came with a specific request, and that was that people in this community support the dinners that they are having. Don talked about this whole self-help concept. And the women in this group are preparing dinners and raising funds to promote their whole program. And so they told us, where you can do that. And I'm just going to give you the address where you can help on that particular strategy. 2922 Forest Avenue, which is Crossroads, on Fridays, they serve dinner every Friday at noontime, I think 11 o'clock. And on Saturday at 2810 Pennsylvania. So those of you who are having committee meetings or you're meeting someone for lunch, that's a good place to go, and you're helping someone at the same time. Okay, we talked about what is possible in Dallas, what can be done, and what's realistic to think about. And one of the pastors in our group talked about the whole question of how do you make people comfortable with the question of social change. And I'm not sure but what that's a contradiction that you just can't be dealt with, but how do you in fact give people rewards for dealing with the question of social change? How do they sit in a meeting under attack? Is that a way to get people to ever deal with the question of social change? Or are there some other ways that we in our congregations and in our meetings can, in fact, get people to deal with the questions that have to be dealt with? We talked at length about all kinds of problems, and one of the great conclusions, which I'm sure everyone has come to, is that oppression is not going to be over soon. That oppression is a big problem, and that our children and grandchildren are going to be dealing with questions of oppression, maybe different kinds of oppression. Maybe it'll be different people oppressing. Who knows? It'll be oppression though, and that the major emphasis for us, if we are to in fact have life, is that the struggle is what's important. The struggle against oppression, and the folks who are not within that struggle have in a sense already lost their life. They're dead people. So we talked about a lot of different kinds of strategies that people can use, and the kinds of ways that some people will be involved where others won't. Talked about the Alliance for Integrated Education. I'm not sure what that is, but there were some folks in our group who were interested in participating in that, and some who said that was not a good strategy for them. But there were other people who said, I would be willing to go and sit in the classroom, just uninvited, go sit and be an observer, or go sit in the courtroom and be an observer. Just be there, see what the judges are doing, see what is just and what is unjust in the courts, document that. I would sit in the waiting room of the hospital or in the emergency room and see what's happening there, be an observer. We felt that was an important thing that citizens could do. Okay, then the last thing that I think is different that hasn't been talked about is just in the business of continuing this conference, that a possible alternative kind of structure might be set up where official representatives of all of the churches in town would in fact come together to deal with the agenda of this conference. It would just be a little bit different kind of structure. But that was our final thing, and really ends on my first point, which is that we are here as a particular people called here because we're parts of churches and because of the National Council of Churches and SMU Perkins, which is a church instrument. And so that's our final word, to pull together that kind of a continuing conference.
Well, that will conclude our initial feedback. It is our intention to consolidate these several reports, and together with any additional comments that you may wish to feed in or supplement the discussion this evening, we'll meet this evening and compile that report in some written form, either abridged or unabridged, depending upon our typing and reproduction capabilities at this hour, and make that available to you tomorrow morning for some consideration and action. Well, that would then conclude our initial feedback, Nat. If there are any questions or any observations that anyone wishes to make at this point, we could, this would be perhaps the time to do so.
Isabella Calora was down at the meeting today with the school board, and she has a report in terms of what happened there, and perhaps you're interested in this. Isabella?
I'll stand up while I'm standing up.
Feels good. I always table hop at meetings because I just can't sit still for more than an hour, so. I met with group four this morning, and we met under this large poster, and one of the first things we noticed was that maybe we should update that poster and put a head of lettuce on the other sign. We were very, we were a kind of friendly group and very informal right from the start, and started off in good humor. I think we had all been impressed with Dr. Carey's remarks of last night. I'll refer to my notes. Dr. Carey told us in part of his talk that becoming better acquainted was simply not enough, and that immediate action was urgent, and the time together should give birth to a course of action. I think our group was filled with that. He told us that it wasn't enough to be sentimental and to tell it like it is, and we really didn't need more intellectual input. What we needed was to energize our wills. That really stuck with our group. We also had some very good Jewish advice last night. Reverend Besser told us to be doers, that persons are known by what they do, and we translated that in our group to the fact that groups are known by what they do. We knew that the hearings at the Dallas Independent School District were taking place this morning. Some of us thought those were open hearings, and immediately it was expressed in the group that perhaps there should be a representative group from this conference at those hearings. Along about that time, somebody came into our group and showed us the statement that had been put together by members of the conference to be sent to the Dallas Independent School District. And it was decided that it would be better if that statement was delivered. And that's what happened. Two of us went down to the Dallas Independent School District to deliver the statement. We thought the hearings were to be open to the public. We went in, went up to the second floor, and we discovered that the seven young men who were to be heard were sitting in the coffee room of the school office there on the second floor, and they were being interviewed by Vivian Mitchell from the Triethnic Committee. We went to them immediately and sat right in. It was a round table, so the two of us just asked if they'd move over, and we sat right in with the group. We showed Vivian Mitchell our statement. We also showed it to the young men, and it was met with approval. In fact, to me, it was rather surprised that such immediate approval. They liked the tone of it, the fact that we were getting to the causes and not dealing simply with symptoms. Vivian very carefully, for 2.5 hours, talked with these seven young men and documented. She has about that thick in a stenographer's notebook, step by step by step, what happened at Woodrow Wilson High School during the, I guess it's about 10 days ago when they had so much trouble over there at Woodrow Wilson High School. She was very careful, and I say that by way of your information. The Triethnic Committee has to be commended for the care with which that was done. I felt perfectly comfortable sitting there. Bill Farmer had to leave. It was Bill and I who went. Al Lipscomb was there already. I felt very comfortable to say that I represented this group, and I'm happy with the same old faces. I don't know how you feel. I consider this a support group. We're supporting one another. So I felt confident in saying that I represented this group. I remembered as I listened and as Vivian carefully spoke with these young men, that once again, Sol Besser's words came to my ears, that laughter is a great communicator, because these young men are they're in a serious situation there, but they have their sense of humor, and every now and then they tell something, and it was quite funny, and we were laughing and trying not to cause a disturbance in the coffee room, because teachers and administrators were coming in and out of there. In fact, Mr. Lipscomb came over and told us to try to settle down now, this was serious. But somehow, you see, that was so human. What 17 or 18-year-old boy can go very long without joking? And while they were talking, every 2 minutes, one would go to the Coke machine, the chips, and they just had to keep eating, too. It was a very human experience. Very serious, however, and very carefully handled. Well, James Jackson was being heard for over 2 hours by administrators, and the school principal was there and also some of the teachers. We never did get into that room. That was done in private. But James was in there for the longest time. Then each of these young men in turn, until 4 o'clock this afternoon, each one was called, and some were called back a second time. Their mothers were there, except those mothers who had to work. One mother had come up out of a sick bed to be there with her son. And mothers very much concerned, and it was very nice to be able to relate to those mothers as a mother myself. The boys have three alternatives. The result of the hearings will be published in 2 or 3 days. One will be to return to Woodrow Wilson High School to complete their course of study. There are 5 seniors in the group and 3 juniors. 2 juniors and a sophomore, I think. But 5 seniors, and you see within 6 weeks they should be graduating. So that's the first alternative. They will be returned to Woodrow Wilson to complete and to receive their diploma. Second one, to go to the Metropolitan School. And this appealed to them as an alternative, because there they can work out their courses to meet their own time schedule, keep their jobs, get an assignment, and report back at their own time and at their convenience, working in with work schedule. And the third one is to have home tutoring. All of these, of course, would be leading to a high school diploma and graduating from Woodrow Wilson. Now, what we offered, by the way, out of this conference, and Bill Farmer and I felt confident in making the offer, that we're to remain in touch with these 8 young men. And whether they're expelled or returned to Woodrow Wilson or go to Metropolitan or come on the home tutoring program, there are many things that we can do to be friends and show we really care. Their names are Robert Benton. Robert's interested in becoming an electrician. He loves art. And Robert says, while you're taking my name, will you take my cousin's name, Castor Shep? Because he needs a friend. Castor Shepherd. Okay, then Henry Bowles is one of the boys. Ray Charles Woods wants to be a doctor. He has a long way to go. He's a high school senior. Ronald is interested in college. He doesn't know which college. He's looking at Oklahoma University. He wants to work a year before going on to college. James Jackson, Jerry Lee is interested in electronics. Wesley Williams is an athlete, proud of it. And Marty O'Trigg is a welder. He likes to weld things, and he also likes to use his welding as an art expression. So I've committed us as an ongoing offer that we would be in touch through the Triethnic Committee with these young men, and I hope that 7 or 8 of us can meet with them soon to follow through on our offer. I see that as a possibility for us as an ongoing program for this group, this personal, human caring and contact. Now the extra, and I'm amused at the proposal that the grandmothers and grandfathers have there, because I'd like to add another one, that they be put on the school list as super volunteers. I talked with Jean Fagadaugh. She came in on a coffee break, and I told her that I had met some wonderful grandmothers, and I named Obelia Black. Where is she? She's the leader. There she is. And that these senior citizens would be such good people to have at Woodrow Wilson on a daily basis. And they could be mediators, advocates, monitors, call them what you will, or just call them grandmothers interested in their own grandchildren. And she will call you, Obelia. She's going to call you at crossroads. And follow through, see how we can get something going there. So I'd just like to close it with that. I see this as a very positive result of this conference. Thank you.
Let me just say this. Unless there are there other remarks, I have an announcement to make. We overlooked 3 important persons in terms of our process here of holding this conference when we were, so to speak, throwing out the accolades. Jean and Parker Wilson. Parker and Jean. They handled the registration along with Nell Farmer, Bill's wife, who was working quite hard there. Anybody else we missed, Bill? I think that we really need to be conscious of folk who really volunteered their time and have graciously given of themselves. And I think that's very important, and I hope that it's part of the human touch which Isabella Calora so beautifully illustrated. Let us, unless there are other kinds of concerns, I think we probably will be dismissed at this point, and I would like to just have a stand, and we'll close out in prayer. Let us pray. Gracious God, our Father, we often do not know how to reach out and touch, but we realize that thou already has taken the initiative to touch us, to humanize us, to shape us in the light of thy Son. We are appreciative of the initiative which thou has taken with us and with all men. And we are also very, very much aware of the various traditions and cultures and races which thou would continually shape in thy gracious and tremendous love and favor. Help us to be more receptive of what thou would share with us. And particularly help us now to reach out in a very human way to touch each other, to dance the dance of life, and to be about the task of shaping an agenda for humanity within our urban environment. We're grateful also for longevity, for wisdom that would come through the eyes and through the minds and through the hearts of our senior citizens. They're beautiful people, and as we live our lives, help us as we move and as we gain and age, help us also to gain the wisdom that has been so eloquently and beautifully demonstrated within our midst today, so that the grave may also be a place where we meet thee, as we meet thee in all areas of our lives, that our movement in terms of age is also a movement to thee. Be with us now and help us to covet the relationship that we have cultivated today and extend our relationship even beyond this place and this time. We pray in thy name. Amen.